The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour, I, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Good Wednesday to you. A lot of show today coming up after the rundown. Dr. Francis Collins of NIH will join me. Selena Zito, Brian Westbury, and then a special edition of the Hillsdale Dialogue. We missed one a couple of weeks ago, and we're making it up today because we have work to do and ground to cover in the third hour. Dr. Larry Arnn will be joining me from Hillsdale College. This morning finds us waiting for news from Israel on whether or not the so-called Change Coalition has reached the necessary agreements to replace Benjamin Netanyahu. It has one major obstacle. Yamina, which is the most conservative party in the coalition, is demanding the not only prime ministership, but for its number two, a position on the Judicial Selection Committee in Israel. That's a five-person committee. Two are by statute, and one is the justice minister, and two are appointed by the coalition, one of whose will be Gideon Saar, who runs New Hope, another conservative party, and the third will be the number two in Yamina. The reason that this matters is that she would, her name is Ayelet Shaked. I hope my pronunciation isn't terrible. That would give conservatives a majority, all right? That would give them an outright majority on the committee that will appoint six of Israel's 15 Supreme Court justices in the next 4 years. So it's a big deal that's not easily overcome. Then there are some parliamentary maneuvers ahead, but it does appear as though they will get it together. You know, the left will eventually yield to get something and be in some government rather than shut out completely by a right-wing government. But also, Ra'am, the Islamist party, has now changed its demand set as well. And, you know, it gets down to short strokes right now. It's knife fighting right now because they've got to get it done by midnight tonight or it reverts to the Knesset. And maybe they can get it done after the Knesset gets the lead, but it's no longer Lapid, the center-left fellow who's in charge of negotiations, who's going to make Naftali Bennett the prime minister. It's a wild, wild west deal in Israel. Let me run through the other headlines in the rundown. China has found a possible first human case of H1N3 bird flu strain, but they said not to worry. Yeah, we really trust the Chinese communists, right? We had a Nixon seminar last night, which will be posted and available if you're a member of the Nixon Foundation, so nixonseminar.com, on Japan's role in the world as the 50th anniversary of the reversion of Okinawa to Japan approaches. And it was just a terrific conversation led by former Secretary of State Pompeo and former National Security Advisor Brian and the members of the seminar. And bottom line, as Matt Pottinger put it, the former Deputy National Security Advisor, Taiwan's defense is Japan's defense. And so watch that space. China's three-child policy may not halt the demographic free fall, according to the Financial Times. This is exactly what Dr. Albert Mohler told me yesterday and told the Ed Board meeting of the Salem Media Corporation, the same thing yesterday, that they just do not. Nothing works if it's totalitarian driven. Once a country begins to decline its birth rate, and this is words of the wise to the United States as well, it's hard to recover it like a GDP number. People's lives change, their whole attitude change, and children become less and less the object of life as they are intended to be for married couples. Brazil's GDP has surged back to pre-pandemic level. Economic expansion is beating expectation. But while they get better in some places of the world, they're getting worse in Peru, which is on the brink of electing a hard left government, communist government, like Venezuela and Cuba, which has got many, many people fleeing the country and moving, especially their money abroad. A Russian criminal gang has ransomware to meat supplier JBS. Thousands of workers stood down in North America and Australia as they deal with that. Oil prices are skyrocketing as OPEC producers agree that they will begin to increase production the oil price went to $71.34 an ounce a barrel. Too bad we're not in on that because of Biden-era anti-energy policies. In fact, the Biden administration suspended oil leases in the Arctic Refuge yesterday. Remember how we won that finally after 30 years, just like the Keystone XL pipeline? With a stroke of his pen, Biden has said, no, we're not doing that. So that means the reason you're paying for gas at the pump is because America's independence, oil independence, being given away by President Biden and his team, suspending all oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Reserve. The Interior Secretary, Deb Haaland, ordered the new environmental review, which is just a way of saying we're not going to do that, even though it's been approved by Congress. It's really scofflawish. Speaking of that Interior Secretary, she came from Congress, vacated a seat, which was filled last night by a Democrat, as expected, Melanie Stansing. No upset here. Biden won the district by 23 points. Looks like a 24-point win by the new Democrat. That means the House is now 220 Democrats to 211 Republicans. There are two vacancies in Ohio, which will be filled in November, expected to split 1-1, and one in Florida in January. So Nancy Pelosi is going to be operating with a five-member swing. She can only lose, she can lose four, not five members, and win. But the Republicans look good to get the House back. Big story in the courts, racial bias in COVID relief. That's not happening anymore. District court stopped it in Texas, and the Sixth Circuit stopped it, period, from this SBA. And that is a great, great thing. There should not be any awarding of benefits or infliction of penalty based upon race, unless there is past, documented, definitive discrimination, and the remedy goes to the individuals discriminated against. It doesn't forbid legislative action, for example, to make reparations to survivors of the Tulsa massacre, which was what President Biden celebrated yesterday, the anniversary. He didn't celebrate it. He marked the 100th anniversary of the massacre in Tulsa. But racially specific remedies, such as may come in the L.A. housing crisis, can only follow racially specific discrimination. Now, that did occur in Los Angeles. So the federal judge out there, David Carter, can fashion race-based remedies and gender-based remedies, since Skid Row was originally the product of gender bias, send all the drunks and all the men and all the unemployed guys to 50 square blocks. Speaking of race controversies, the editor of the medical journal JAMA had to step down. He had to resign because he had tweeted that he's offended when people accuse him of racism. I don't understand that story at all. There's a new water war in the West in the Klamath Basin along the California-Oregon border. Fish have been dying en masse. Farmers are infuriated. They've been cut off by their water source. Good luck. The water wars are back. Team Trump ran them efficiently so that farmers did not lose everything. But they are back in the hands of environmental extremists, just like the Arctic drilling. Environmental extremists have flooded back into Interior, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, and they're just not going to fix the water wars up there. Leader McConnell signaled he will not support changes to qualified immunity. He wants police to be protected the way that they are now. President Biden added to the border as an issue set for Vice President Harris. He put her in charge of getting voting rights legislation passed. Ha! He doesn't like her much. He really doesn't. He gave her the border, which she can't do anything about and is a disaster. And now he's tasked her with getting SB1, the radical piece of legislation, passed. That's not going to happen. President Trump's company puts its D.C. hotel lease up for sale again. For those of you who come to D.C. and go into the Trump Hotel, I've been in there twice since it opened. I was invited many more times than that, but I consider it spy central, so I don't like to go in there and leave my phone behind. The Southwest is America's new factory hub. Cranes everywhere, says the Wall Street Journal. These states, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and Oklahoma, added 100,000 manufacturing jobs from January 17 to January 20, representing 30% of U.S. job growth. This is an amazing story, which I'll talk about in the next segment. $1 million bid over asking came in for a house on Reno Road in D.C. The list price was, I don't know, $3.5 million, and the offer was $4.5 million. And I note in Anaheim, an elderly man was attacked randomly and murdered 3 days ago. That sounds like mental illness to me, as it usually is when there are these random attacks. And the homeless problem is deeply connected with this. It really is. Tesla is in hot water because of Elon Musk's tweets, according to the SEC. And look, I don't follow tennis, but Naomi Osaka dropped out of the French Open because of the media. Let's call the media for what it is. Increasingly unacceptable to people who operate in its spotlight on courts and fields. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I'm looking at Selena Zito's most recent column, and I'm trying to type out a stunning fact that I don't think many people know outside of Selena Zito, which is that all of the Appalachian states include New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and all of West Virginia. You know, Selena, I would guess that since the movie came out with Burt Reynolds, that it's been, everyone just thinks Appalachia is West Virginia, but you went to the very starting geographic point and then headed all the way south on it.
Yeah, it starts in New York and goes all the way down to Mississippi. And what's really interesting is in where it starts in New York, it's, you know, maybe 30 minutes from Albany. But yet the town where it starts has probably more in common with Mississippi, you know, parts of Mississippi where it ends in Georgia than it does with Albany. It has a very distinct and rich and interesting culture that is really prevalent throughout the whole diagonal swath that goes through the country.
Now, what's interesting about Appalachia, you point out, was settled by the Ulster Scots. And that James Webb's book, Born Fighting, is about the Ulster Scots. And I'm an Ulster Scot. And so I get the whole born fighting thing. But I didn't realize that there was a council for Appalachia. Tell people about this organization and whether or not it actually works.
It's the Appalachian Regional Council. It was formed in 1964 after JFK went there and noted how economically behind this region was. And he was just sort of struck by how consistent it went throughout this whole swath of the country. And he went there in April of 1963, and he was in West Virginia, and he started the council. He met with his cabinet, and a month later, unfortunately, you know, a couple months after that, he was dead. But LBJ picked up the mantle and went with it and developed the council in 1964. And it's had good success and it's had not so good success. I mean, part of Appalachia's problem is its greatest asset, which is its location. They're filled with hills and valleys, but it makes, you know, getting from point A to point B almost absolutely impossible.
Yeah.
It's great for tourism. It's not so great for economic development.
Well, I love this paragraph in your column. Hollywood calls them hillbillies or rednecks. Politicians refer to them as deplorable, bitter clingers or Neanderthals. Corporations and sports entities ignore them. Academics and media believe they are all racist. The last one makes all of them shake their heads and chuckle because they are more likely to work side by side with their hands or serve their country with a more diverse population than most elites ever will. That's the unknown story of the Appalachian Mountains.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And they really are befuddled by people calling them racist when they look at each other and say, oh, you know, we spend more time with diverse group of people than y'all ever do. I don't know why you think that you can just throw that word around about us.
So they are overwhelmingly Trumpists, though, are they not? Overwhelmingly Donald Trump supporters.
Overwhelmingly, which is what is interesting, if you look at that swath of geography, it was overwhelmingly Democrats less than 10 years ago. That's how much the part, they have not changed. That is how much the parties have changed.
What do they think about the modern Democratic Party and Joe Biden? Do they identify it as the left lurching hybrid of green consciousness and critical race theory?
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with climate change, believe it or not. I think this is really interesting. When you talk to people in Appalachia about climate change, they never once say, oh, it doesn't exist. They are all very conscious about being good caretakers of the climate and the environment, because that's where they live. They're the same people that live and work and breathe and fish and kayak and swim and hunt in the areas where coal is mined or shale is extracted or industry is so they more than anybody else wants to make sure that a company is doing the right thing, but they don't think it should be used as a religion.
And that is why this series of columns Selena Zito is writing for the Washington Examiner on Appalachia is just so good. Selena, always a pleasure. The INSA Report. Until next week, we'll talk then. Stay tuned. Dr. Francis Collins coming up in the next hour on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it 3 times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours 2 and 3 when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that 3-week starter pack, $19.95. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. Joined now by Dr. Francis Collins of the National Institute for Health. Hello, Dr. Collins. How are you again?
I'm just fine. How are you this morning?
I'm great. I'm dog sitting, so you've got an extra person in the studio with me this morning.
I'll try not to let my cat get on the screen because we might have a problem.
We would. Dr. Collins, I want to start with trials and then go to trust, the 2T interview. First of all, I got a bunch of questions from people who participated in trials when vaccine candidates were up. What is the advice NIH has for them on getting boosters or other vaccines, or if they did a trial that wasn't one that ended up working?
Well, that's something that is up to the companies that they took part in the trials. I think virtually all of them, once the trial is completed, have been offered the chance to get immunized with either the vaccine that was approved because they were part of that trial, and maybe they got the placebo, or with a different vaccine. So, yeah, definitely nobody should be compromised by having volunteered to take part in these trials. We are, all of us, in their debt. 100,000 people for the Moderna, the Pfizer, the J&J trial made it possible for us to know that these things work. And they should certainly, of all people, be well covered now.
So there are two categories there. The first question I get from people, it did work for me. My spouse got it. But now, when do we get guidance on whether or not we have to get another booster or a second shot? Is that out there? Does that come from the people that gave it to you?
So I think now you're talking about anybody who got vaccinated. Are we going to need boosters in the future, or are you covered for the foreseeable? We don't know what the long-term duration is of protection from the vaccines that are currently in more than 150 million people's arms. It's looking pretty good when you look at the data we have, because we haven't had this vaccine out there for that long. It looks like the levels stay up pretty well over 6, 7, 8 months. But I don't know what they'll look like at a year or 2 years. Are we going to need boosters for everybody the way you do for your tetanus? The other issue, Hugh, is those variants that are out there. And so far, you know, we now call them alpha, beta, gamma, and delta instead of those numbers. So far, the vaccines look like they protect you against all of those slightly scary viruses that are more contagious, but they do seem to be protected. But I worry about what's down the line here. Will we see a variant emerge in the next few months the vaccines don't quite work for? And then you'll need a booster for that. So
that zeroes us in over the target. Some of the people who got the trial vaccines are now past a year. They're, in fact, 15 months after or 14 months after they got the shot. What about them in boosters? Should they get one just to be safe?
No, not yet. Not yet. It's looking pretty good. And again, the people who got the trials the earliest, the phase one trial, those were only a few dozen people. The big trials, the so-called phase three, started at the end of July. And most of those people didn't really get injected with their first dose until like August, September. And they didn't have their second dose until a month after that. So the big data that we have to work on is more like 7 or 8 months. It's not a year, but it's looking good.
So forthcoming. Now, let me turn to the National Institute of Virology in China, Doctor. Josh Rogan and I have been working on this for a couple of years, and we're in our second year of looking at WIV. And you were in front of Energy and Commerce. Kathy McMorris Rogers sent you a long letter full of questions. They got back a two-page non-response. Did you oversee that response, Dr. Collins? Because McMorris Rogers' staff is not pleased.
Well, it was quite a letter they sent. I think it was like 29 questions, 11 pages, 40 footnotes, getting deep into all kinds of territory that was beyond our ability to come up with quick answers to. So we did our best to try to be respectful and put forward a response on the high-level issues. But clearly, they want to have further conversation. I think we also volunteered that maybe this would be an opportunity to just talk to them instead of having this long list of questions and many, many, many pages of letters and emails. Why don't we actually discuss it?
Well, now, Doctor, this is where I'm not a scientist. I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn, but I do know government, and I've been confirmed by the Senate. When I went up there, I had to answer every question when I got confirmed. And when I was a general counsel of agencies and my agency got asked questions, we had to answer every subparagraph. Why would the NIH not go to the effort of being fully responsive? Because it does give off the appearance of evasion.
Well, I sure don't want to create that appearance, Hugh. I think we want to be as transparent as possible. NIH has always been in favor of that and of being responsive, regardless of who the questions are coming from. But this is an incredibly complicated story. Much of the information they're asking for, we don't have the answers to. Some of it is pretty sensitive, not quite classified, but getting close to that. So just didn't seem like this was going to be well served by having a very, very detailed exchange of letters. And again, in our response, we offered to have the chance to simply get into a secure space and have a conversation.
Now, Doctor, that would be a good response, which is we need to do this in a SCIF. But NIH got into trouble by arrogating to itself the decision-making authority. And I'm a big fan of Dr. Fauci, but he said I was trying to influence behavior, so I answered it differently than I otherwise would have. When NIH doesn't respond to congressionally authorized committees, that does raise questions of governance. We're a nation of laws. NIH is a creature of the federal government, and the Congress oversees NIH. So if I can go back around, I don't want to be rude, but I really think you ought to go down paragraph by paragraph and answer each question, even if it is we have to discuss this in a SCIF.
And again, I think that's the proposal we're making. But let's try to do this in a fashion that actually improves the opportunity for information exchange instead of making it very rigorous, very bureaucratic, very okay, 40 footnotes, 29 questions. We need your 30-page response to this. I'm not sure that's going to help us as much as actually trying as best we can to talk to each other about what we know and what we don't know. There's an awful lot we don't know. You know, Hugh, this whole issue about whether something happened at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, nobody knows. The really critical thing is there needs to be a thorough investigation. The WHO effort did not meet that standard. We need something that's going to be expert-driven with complete openness by the Chinese government to give answers to questions they have not answered. We're really frustrated by that as well. And so for me to be able to say, well, okay, I'm going to answer Kathy McMorris Rogers' letter and it'll all settle. It won't settle it because we just don't know what happened.
Well, yeah, but giving a stab at it, the best possible stab is, I think, so crucial to maintaining NIH credibility, which I think is vital. Let me go to the EcoHealth Alliance. Again, I'm a general counsel of two federal agencies in the past. I know how this stuff works. When you give a grant, the money ends up going to the Wuhan Institute of Virology through the EcoHealth Alliance, you're inevitably supporting all the research at any grantee because overhead is built into every grant. Now, there were 2 5-year grants. One was terminated, according to NPR. Doesn't that put the federal government in the position of having supported WIV at some level for some function? Because money is fungible.
Well, when we give a grant, Hugh, it has terms attached to it of what it is that the grantee is supposed to be doing with those funds. And we require annual reports to see whether that, in fact, is what they have been doing. And we trust the grantee to be honest and not deceptive. The grant funds that went to Wuhan, which were a subcontract from EcoHealth, were very specifically aimed to try to categorize viruses that they could isolate from bats in Chinese caves, which we had a good reason to want to know more about, given SARS and MERS that had come out of there. And so we basically have those criteria attached to the grant. And of course, the amount of money that we were providing to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, I'm sure was a tiny fraction of their total funding. And we had no control over what else they were doing with those funds. That's another thing we'd like to know more about, and an investigation might potentially tell us.
So they have, according to the head of the EcoHealth Alliance, they had collected 15,000 samples because of the grant, including 400 new coronaviruses. I have a larger question about whether that's a good idea, period, to go looking for the viruses that can then subsequently escape from labs, possibly. But more importantly, what I do know a lot about from my time at Justice and the White House back in the day is the Chinese Communist Party. And I don't know why we would ever trust the Chinese Communist Party, Doctor. Even if EcoHealth Alliance is made up of great American scientists, they get 90% of their money from the federal government. So it looks to an outsider like a pass-through and a cutout organization that somehow gets money to the Chinese. And I wouldn't trust the CCP scientists because they don't have freedom of science like we do in the United States. You can tell people to pound sand. They can't do that. They'll end up in a gulag in Xinjiang.
Well, Hugh, again, let me just try to argue, although I'm not sure you're convinced of it. Okay, we have had, prior to SARS-CoV-2 as a terrible pandemic, 2 other episodes of very serious coronaviruses that emerged apparently from bats in China. We at the NIH have to think about what the next risk is going to be. Remember, thousands of people died from SARS. Do we really want to just sort of say, well, we can't investigate that because it involves China and they have some political issues that we're a bit uncomfortable with? I think that would be irresponsible. So if we had the chance to learn more about those viruses, remember, when a pandemic happens, it's not limited to any part of the world. It's global. If we have a chance to learn more about those in a fashion where we have an agreement about what research is to be done and that the results are supposed to be shared, shouldn't we be doing that? Or should we just basically close up and say we're just not going to work with any country that has politics we're uncomfortable with? I don't think that would be responsible.
Doctor, that's a kind of a shift. It's not that we have political issues with the government that we're a bit uncomfortable with. What I perhaps have a little advantage over you is I did counterintelligence at the Department of Justice. They are not political issues with which we are uncomfortable. It's a totalitarian state that executes people, suppressed Hong Kong and runs prison camps and a gulag. And in fact, about which we have called genocide in the last 2 years. When the grant was made, that was not the case. I understand the danger. But when we combine my 2 issues, non-responsiveness to Kathy McMorris Rogers with the nature of a totalitarian Chinese communist regime, we have the reason for congressional oversight. Maybe we wouldn't be here with American money going to the CIV if oversight had gone effectively deep into the NIH policies and not through a cutout organization, EcoHealth Alliance. Does that make sense to you why my expertise would say, gosh, no, we're never giving money to the Chinese communist government, ever?
I'm still not convinced that you're making a case that would change our responsibility as the leading organization for pursuing biomedical research in the world, including overseeing risks of a global pandemic, the one thing that keeps us all up at night. We still had to figure out the best way, not a perfect way, to try to gain that information to prepare for what might be a troubling problem downstream. So I think we had to do what we had to do. I'm totally open to defending that and to being as transparent as possible in the appropriate place about what exactly we did fund and what we did not fund. But I think when the dust all settles, a reasonable person will say we were doing what NIH should do to try to protect the public against a terrible outbreak.
Now, that's interesting. That's a philosophical problem, Doctor, because the question becomes, is there any regime that NIH would not fund directly or through a cutout organization? Would you give money to North Korea, which everybody knows is the worst actor in the world? I mean, would you give them? They've got bats in North Korea as well. Would you send them money?
Probably not. Again, I think you're demonizing the Wuhan Institute of Virology as it is pure and simple an instrument of the Chinese Communist Party. There are certainly connections there. But let's be clear. There are scientists working in that institute who are amongst the best in the world in terms of understanding virology. And many of those folks have had long-term relationships with others in other countries, including the United States, with a lot of respect, a lot of shared information. I don't think we should just basically say, well, because they're in that country, they're evil. I think you're going too far with that one.
I don't think the scientists are evil. I think the scientists are coerced. Have you had a chance to read Josh Rogan's Chaos Under Heaven yet, Doctor?
No, I have not.
I would strongly recommend it. And that's just the latest of many books. I've been doing China and Russia and counterespionage for 30 years, so I know this stuff. There is not a free actor in China. There is not a scientist. Didn't someone from the virology lab get disappeared when they put the DNA code up?
We don't know that. I don't think, no, not the person who put the code up, who agreed as the plane door was closing to allow Eddie Holmes in Australia to post it. That was a wonderful step forward. That made it possible for us to start our vaccine preparation within 24 hours, which is now saving lots and lots of lives. So there's an example of China being willing to make information available very early that otherwise could have readily been delayed.
Oh, gosh, Doctor. Now, last question, because we're running short on time. The president has ordered a new counterintelligence intelligence community investigation. I assume NIH will be cooperating with that. But I want to go back to that oversight issue and that letter from McMorris Rogers and any letter from Senator Cotton or anybody else. NIH is a creature of the federal government. I think you've got to answer these because I want you and Dr. Fauci to maintain credibility. Where are we on that process? If they say, no, I want my letter answered, you're the director. What are you going to tell your general counsel?
Again, I think we have offered to have a conversation as the next step. I think that would be the most useful step and not to get quite so rigorous and oriented in this fashion of letter exchanges and waiting to see how that might basically take shape.
And if they disagree?
Well, you must realize at this point, the White House is engaged. They are engaging in this larger level of investigation. We are not a completely free agency to just decide what we're going to do. We have to correlate all of our efforts with the Department of Health and Human Services, which I'm part of, with Secretary Becerra, and with the White House right to the top.
I agree with that. If they direct you not to answer, that's an executive privilege issue. But that isn't the case yet, is it, Doctor?
I think there are lots of concerns about exactly how best to respond to many of these very detailed, sensitive questions for which we don't have ready answers. So it has not been really resolved about how best to handle this.
Dr. Collins, thank you. Please keep coming back. It's a key issue for credibility, so I wish you good luck in satisfying Congress, which I was never able to do either. So good luck on that one. Dr. Francis Collins from NIH, thank you for joining me again.
Thanks, you. Have a good one.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I just happen to have standing by America's leading and favorite economist, Brian Westbury of First Trust Portfolio. Brian, good morning. How are you?
I am excellent. It's turning into spring and summer everywhere. That's awesome.
I know. Now, you just happened to follow a conversation I just had with Dr. Francis Collin, director of the NIH, about the funding of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And I'm not a scientist, and I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn. But if you give a grant to an organization, are you giving a grant to everyone in the organization for all the research they are doing, or can you segregate the funds effectively, Brian Westbury, as an economist?
Yeah, Hugh, in all my experience, what I have learned is that you cannot segregate the funds. I'll just use one example here. It's definitely not as dangerous, at least to health. But in Illinois, we started a lottery, and the hundreds of millions of dollars every year that was going to take from people that were playing was supposed to pay for education. Well, they moved that money to education, but they took away other money. So in the end, money is fungible. They spend it wherever they want. They promise all kinds of things. But then when the doors are closed and no one's looking, they do what they want.
So Brian, can you explain money is fungible? We got Steelers fans listening, and they think money is green. So can you explain what that means?
Yes, money is fungible. In other words, it moves around. That once it's on your budget, if no one is looking over your shoulder, writing checks for you, you can use it for anything you want. It's like a father giving his kid some money to pay the rent, but the kid goes out to the bars and drinks beers instead. There's no way to know once you Venmo that money to wherever it's going.
No, you use Venmo. That's going to confuse the Steelers fans, too. Now, let's apply that same rule to a totalitarian regime like the People's Republic of China. When you invest in a Chinese company or you give a grant to a Chinese lab, they've got great scientists and great businessmen. But what's the role of the government in both of those situations?
Yeah, I won't claim to be a complete expert on the government in China to every detail. But it is clear that in a communist country like China that is driven by literally a central committee, a small group of people that make decisions, that once they've made a decision, resources head in that direction. And they have a lot of tools, some of them pretty nasty, to make sure that people follow those directions. So any resource that's there will be pushed in the direction that the central committee wants it to go, no matter where it is, in a private company, in a public institute, I guess you can say anything in China is public because the central committee controls it all.
Yeah, if you give money to the mob, the mob's going to use the money wherever they want. Brian, let me get quickly over to inflation. Jerry Boyer and I had a conversation yesterday where he tells me the Fed systematically understates inflation because they don't use CPI. Do you agree with that assessment? What do you think is our real rate of inflation right now?
Yeah, there are many issues with the measures of inflation that we have in the United States. We could spend hours talking about all the different measures, how lots of them are twisted a little bit. For example, if when we first put catalytic converters on automobiles, let's say that's to knock down emissions from gasoline engines. Let's say that costs $300 to go on a car. Well, that would boost the price of the car by $300. However, the government was saying, well, that improves the environment, so we're going to knock off $270 of that. So while you're paying $300 more for the car, according to the statisticians in the government, it only costs $30 more. And so there are a number of things that they do like that. So I do believe they systematically lower inflation. It's not as much as some people believe, but it does go to some extent. Here's my worry. Go back to the 1970s, and all during the 70s, we had inflation going up, 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 up. And every year when they published their statements, they published their research. They said, this is just temporary. It's because of OPEC. It's because of the dollar. It's because of that storm down in the South. It's because of, they dismissed it over and over and over again until we ended up with 20% interest rates. And that's what worries me about it today, is that they are dismissing it. They call it transitory, temporary, anything they can do to ignore inflation. But in the end, they're printing too much money. And that's what causes inflation. You can't stop it. It is inevitable. Milton Friedman taught us this, and he's not wrong.
When we come back next week, Brian, we're going to talk about modern monetary theory, because MMT is the fuel driving the inflationary bus, and we'll talk about it next week. Follow him on Twitter at Westbury. Follow me to Hour 3, a special Hillsdale Dialogue. We catch up. Back to Washington, who's still as relevant today as ever. Dr. Larry Arnn is next on The Hugh Hewitt Show.